seat, please. I want to thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Yitzhak Pincus. Last night, the Computer Science Club held its first student presentation on practical computing. It was the first of a four-part series on web development and design. We plan on having a student presentation every Tuesday, and we already have some of them lined up through March and into May. For tonight, I would like to introduce our guest speaker here from California. He's a co-founder and senior research fellow at the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. He has authored numerous papers on AI. He has also authored The Sequences of Less Wrong and the popular fan fiction Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. Ladies and gentlemen, Eliezer Witkowski.
Good evening. Am I being broadcast at this time? You were supposed to respond yes or no.
Affirmative.
Excellent. Okay, so the question was, can you hear me? But I will try again. Linda's 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in the anti-nuclear demonstrations. Rank the following statements from most probable to least probable. Now, you don't actually have to do that. But when a group of experimental subjects was asked to do that, they found that 89% of the subjects thought Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement was more likely than Linda being a bank teller. Now, if it's not obvious to you that this is wrong, consider that you can only have so many bank tellers, and if not all of the bank tellers are feminists, then it is necessarily the case that there are more bank tellers than people who are feminists and bank tellers. Another similar case. You have a die with four green faces and two red faces. The die is rolled 20 times, you record the series of green and red faces. If your chosen sequence appears, you win $25. This was run with real money on some students, and I'd like you this time to actually take a moment to decide whether you would rather bet on sequence 1, RGRRR, sequence 2, GRGRRR, or sequence 3. G-R-R-R-R-R-R-R, maybe. Now, did everyone pick? Raise your hand if you picked the sequence to bet on. of 125 undergraduates playing this for real money picked sequence 2. Now, the gotcha, of course, is that sequence 1 actually appears inside sequence 2, so it appears anywhere sequence 2 appears. Now, this is known as a conjunction fallacy. It's known as a conjunction fallacy because you're assigning greater probability to the more complicated event, the event that is strictly more complicated. Sequence 2 is equal to sequence 1 plus the additional requirement that it be preceded by green. Is it okay if I remove this? This is just horrible science.
Alrighty, so the conjunction fallacy is called that because it violates an actual law of probability theory, which states that the probability of a compound event A and B is always less than or equal to the probability of A alone. In other words, A, whether or not B happens, is always more probable than A happens and B happens.
This illustrates what's called a heuristic. The heuristic is that when you, what we currently believe to be happening when people pick sequence two is that they want to know which of these sequences is most likely to come up, which of these sequences is most likely to win me $25. But sort of unnoticed, the way their brain processes this question, it swaps it around and asks, which of these sequences most resembles the die? Now, the die is mostly green, so the sequence with the most green in it will appear to most resemble the die. Judgment of representativeness has been substituted for judgment of probability. And this works a lot of the time. It's a decent heuristic, but it also gives rise to a systematic predictable bias. You can experimentally reproduce a certain type of human error. At the Second International Congress on Forecasting, two groups of professional analysts were asked to rate, first group was asked to rate the probability of a suspension of diplomatic relations between the USA and the Soviet Union, which we still had back then, versus a Russian invasion of Poland and a complete suspension of diplomatic relations between the USA and the Soviet Union. And the group asked to rate version two responded with significantly higher probabilities. It's another case of the conjunction fallacy because version two is the strictly more complicated story. And the moral of all this is that even though adding detail to a story necessarily makes that story less probable, the detail can also make it sound more plausible. This brings us to the artificial intelligence part of the talk, which we'll be getting to in just a few more moments, don't worry. But in general, when you talk about the future, if you look at the people who are selling you futurism, you'll find two kinds of people out there who are doing futurism. There's a group of people who are telling you wonderfully detailed, entertaining stories that sound nicely plausible. And there are people who are weighing each and every additional detail that they add to their stories and asking, can I justify this detail? Does it hold up under scrutiny? And almost anything you see on television is likely to be storytelling of the entertaining type. If you want the careful futurism, and there really is a just tremendous difference between these two professions once you sort of realize that the keynote is how complicated are their stories and can they support each independent detail. And if you want detail-supported futurism, you want to look at, say, the Oxford Future of Humanity Institute. It's generally done more by analytic philosophers than by the sort of people you see on television. Also, in this introduction, I've introduced a very counterintuitive idea, except that this audience, I hope, will actually not find it so counterintuitive. The idea is that there are rules for how to think. Even if you're dealing with probabilities, there are rules for how you handle your own uncertainty. I'd expect this to be, you know, one of the rare upsides of Yeshiva education, is that by the time you're done processing all that Gemara, the idea that there are rules for asking questions and answering them should probably not be all that counterintuitive. Now, I can't think of a single other education anywhere that is actually going to teach you that there are rules for how to think. Insensitivity to predictivity. Some experimental subjects were presented with a description of a teacher giving a lesson. Some students were asked to evaluate the quality of the lesson, like, is this in the top 10% of the lessons, the bottom 20% of lessons? Is it about average? Is it in like the 50% lessons are worse, 50% are better? Some other subjects were asked to predict the percentile standing of the teacher 5 years later. Like, 5 years later, will this be in the top 20% of teachers, the bottom 20% of teachers? And they gave equally extreme judgments. Now, why is this odd? Because if the quality of a single lesson does not perfectly predict how good of a teacher you are 5 years later, then it can't be the case that you go get more extreme from today to 5 years from now. The top 20% of teachers cannot all end up in the top 10% of teachers. Even if it's perfectly predictable, the top 20% of teachers now would be in the top 20% of teachers then. If there's any regression to the mean, if it is less than perfectly diagnostic. Some of the people who seem like good teachers now will seem like worse teachers later, and someone who gives a lesson that's in the top 10% of lessons, due to random noise, they'll probably be in only, say, the top 20% of teachers 5 years later. So the other thing that you will find in incautious futurism is that they have no idea what they can predict and what they can't predict. They will try to predict anything. It is sort of the equivalent of saying, based on this one lesson that I'm getting a paper description of, how good of a teacher will this be 5 years later? There's no, you know, we don't automatically realize, wait a minute, this information that I have is not perfectly diagnostic. We just, we don't ask how much noise there is in our judgments. We don't ask how little we know. And as those of you who have read Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality will remember, the fundamental question of rationality is, what do you think you know, and how do you think you know it? Most aspects of the future are simply not very predictable. For me to come here and say that I know anything at all about the future, which is generally not all that predictable, or about the role of artificial intelligence in the future, is a rather sort of burdensome statement. You should demand that I argue it well. Now, in point of fact, this is not going to be a 20-hour talk, and therefore I will not be able to argue it half as well as I would like. But I do want to sort of, you know, it's an attitude that a yeshiva audience in particular, I would expect to understand exactly what I mean. When someone comes to you and claims that they know something about the future, first thing you ask them is, what do you think you know, and how do you think you know it? So, something I think I know. I know that one of these technologies is not like the others. One of these technologies doesn't belong. Can you guess which one is not like the other before I finish my song? And if any of you did not recognize that tune, you can raise your hand and make me feel really old. Thank you to the girl in the second row. So, one of these technologies is not like the others because we have three cool gadgets and one thing that actually has something to do with the mind. You know, going between planets is cool. Curing cancer is cool and very good. And nanomanufacturing is cool and possibly good, possibly very bad, has a very large impact upon the economy, but one of these trumps all the others. Now, it's not because it has the word artificial in it, it's because it has the word intelligence in it. We sort of overlook the power of intelligence because we already have fire, we already have language, we already have nuclear weapons, and so we forget that chimpanzees, or for that matter, rocks, do not have any of these capabilities. When you think of intelligence, don't think of getting a high score on the test. That's just sort of the, you know, a rather minor use of intelligence. Think of skyscrapers, think of spaceships, think of money, think of science, think of being human. Talking about intelligence, you know, evokes images of calculus, chess, good recall of facts, social persuasion, enthusiasm. It's not a function of your liver. It happens in the brain somewhere. What do I think I can guess? I think I can guess that technologies which impact upon cognition, which have something to do with thinking and how we think, will end up mattering the most to the shape of the future because intelligence is something more powerful and significant than all the wonderful, amazing gadgetry that popular magazines are going to tell you is futuristic. And because futuristic is a word that marketers use to sell you products. They want you to associate the word futuristic with your iPhone. So they give you this notion that the future is about which interesting devices that you have. There's an alternative perspective, pioneered, I would say, by Werner Vinge, which says that the human brain has been more or less constant for the last 50,000 years, and if you do anything which significantly changes the human brain, or significantly changes the sort of intelligences that are doing the thinking around here, you have made a break with the past that is unlike the invention of your iPhone, it is unlike the invention of electricity, it is unlike the invention of agriculture, because for the very first time, sometime in the next few decades, we are going to have technologies that change the type of thinking that gets done on this planet. What else do I think I know? I'd like to tell a little drasha. And the drasha is, imagine a planet where nobody has the faintest idea how to add anything. You know, they can sort of add instinctively, intuitively, but they have no idea what exactly they're doing when they perform addition. So they try to build artificial adding machines. And the way they try to build their artificial adding machines is by entering in a list of interesting arithmetical facts such that when you take the number 7 and the number 6 and you put them together, you get 13. And you take the number 9 and the number 6 and put them together, you get 15. And when you take the number 7 and the number 2 and put them together, you get 9. But their machine cannot take these first three facts and deduce from it that 13 plus 2 is 15, which does logically follow, because they don't quite realize how addition works. And in this alternative world, there are machines that will add numbers up to 20, but you know, doing truly general addition like humans do, and adding numbers in the range of 40 to 60 to even 100, you know, that is beyond the reach of current technology. Only humans can add numbers that high. And in this world, there are some views on the problem of artificial general addition. For example, there's the idea that addition is a framing problem. What 21 plus equals is depends on whether it's plus 3 or plus 4. So the way to get artificial general addition is that you just have to program in enough of those tiny little detailed facts that you can, you know, cover most of the territory you need addition for. Then there's an alternative approach, which says that you need an artificial arithmetician which can understand natural language so that it can learn all those different arithmetical facts by reading the World Wide Web. There's the idea that the only way to develop a general arithmetician is to do it the same way nature did, natural selection. There's the idea that top-down approaches have just failed to produce arithmetic, and that you need a bottom-up approach to make addition emerge. There's the idea that you can do it using neural networks, which work just like the human brain, and that can be trained to perform addition without ever understanding how they work. Or that the reason that you can't program artificial general addition is that you just don't have calculators as powerful as the human brain, and that Moore's law says that we'll get calculators as powerful as the human brain on April 27, 2031, between 4 and 4:30 in the morning. Or that the best way to get an artificial general adder is to scan in a human brain and simulate the neural circuitry that humans use for addition. Since, after all, humans are the only known study of addition that really works. There's the idea that since Gödel's theorem shows no formal system can ever capture the properties of arithmetic and classical physics is formalizable, clearly addition must exploit quantum gravity. But really, if arithmetic were simple enough to program, if human arithmetic were simple enough to program, for humans to program, we couldn't count high enough to build computers. Then there's John Searle's Chinese calculator experiment, and the idea that we will never know the nature of arithmetic because the problem is just too hard. Lesson one, when you're missing a basic insight, you must find that insight. Workarounds may sound clever, they're not. You cannot talk sensibly about solutions until you are no longer confused, and conversely, when you actually do find a solution, the way you'll know it's a solution is that you will no longer be confused after you know it. If I tell you, for example, that arithmetic is an emergent property of bottom-up systems, it feels like you know a new fact, but you can't actually make any new experimental predictions, and it still has the same sort of wonderful, mysterious quality that it had before I told you that it was emergent. The word emergence is actually functionally isomorphic to the word magic, but that's a whole separate thing. Rule number two, if you have to put an infinite number of surface cases into your computer, it means you do not understand the underlying process that is generate all these separate cases you are putting in. Now, you may ask, well, but how do you know that intelligence is understandable? Maybe it is just a permanent mystery. Maybe there is something inherently mysterious about intelligence. Now, I'd like to regale you with one of my favorite quotes. It's by a fellow named Lord Kelvin. Poor Lord Kelvin. He said, you know, he had a good scientific career, helped lay the first transatlantic cable, and gave his name to the Kelvin scale of temperature, and will be remembered forever after for a few really stupid things that he said that were extremely quotable, one of which is as follows. The influence of animal or vegetable life on matter is infinitely beyond the range of any scientific inquiry hitherto entered on. Its power of directing the motions of moving particles, in the demonstrated daily miracle of our human free will, and the growth of generation after generation of plants from a single seed, are infinitely different from any possible result of the fortuitous concurrence of atoms. Modern biologists were coming once more to the acceptance of something, and that was a vital principle. This being from back in the 19th century, where no one really had any idea of biology worked, no one knew that there were tiny little molecular machines down there, and so they thought it was magic. They didn't actually call it magic. That would not have been scientifically respectable in the 19th century. They called it élan vital, but it was semantically the same as magic, because telling you that it was élan vital or vis vitalis told you exactly as much as telling you that it was magic in terms of what new experimental predictions it let you make, i.e. none. And this is just a sort of useful quote to remember, because it always, you know, every time you run into something new that is mysterious, it comes as a tremendous shock to the current generation. Now, if you'd actually lived over the past 3,000 years, and you'd seen the stars go from everlasting permanent mysteries to the domain of science, and you had seen life go from an everlasting permanent mystery to the domain of science, and you had seen chemistry, matter, go from the domain of alchemy to the domain of science, and then you looked at the brain and you didn't quite understand how it worked on your very first try, you'd say, I'm not falling for that one again. But people have no sense of history. And they think that, you know, chemistry has never been mysterious. The stars have never been mysterious. These things have always been the proper domain of science. And anyone who used to think the stars were mysterious, well, they were just being silly, going all mystical about such an obviously scientific subject as biology. And then you run across intelligence and you don't know how it works and you panic. Don't panic. As Edwin Thompson James once said, if you are ignorant of a phenomenon, this is a fact about your state of mind, not a fact about the phenomenon itself, which I sometimes summarize as saying, a blank map does not correspond to a blank territory. Or, ignorance is in the mind, not in reality. So if you see something that seems wonderfully mysterious, and you start worshiping it because it seems so wonderfully mysterious, what you are actually worshiping is your own ignorance. Because there is no way that the world itself can have the property of being unknown. All ignorance is always some particular person who is ignorant of something. You cannot solidify ignorance and have it be, you know, a special kind of ignorant atom, you know, that where you have a lot of ignorant atoms that used to make a large amount of ignorance. No, ignorance is a property of minds, not of, you know, thingy-dingies. What do I think I can guess about the future, which is generally not very predictable? I think I can guess that today's difficulties in constructing artificial intelligence are not because intelligence is inherently, permanently, and everlastingly in a separate category of mysterious things apart from biology or the stars, but because we still don't know what the heck we're doing. What else do I think I know? How do I think I know it? I think that The projector has stopped working. Yes. The more amazing labor-saving devices we have, the more time we spend getting them to work.
There we go.
I think that there is a design space of possibilities for how you can construct minds that is very much wider than the space of human minds. That's actually a claim I'll be supporting in more detail a bit later. And I think that human minds are actually pretty near the bottom of the cosmic scale of what sort of intelligent physical objects you can construct. This is very clear when you look at the brain's hardware. You've got the neurons transmitting their little electrochemical spikes by pumping ions in and out of the membrane of the neuron, with the result that it's transmitting signals at the breakneck speed of 1 meter or even 100 meters per second, less than a millionth the speed of light. Even in the realm of heat dissipation, well, we also know that, you know, your computer has a clock speed on it that says something like 2.2 gigahertz, which means 2.2 billion clicks per second. Whereas a very rapidly spiking neuron will fire maybe 200 times per second, or about 1/10 millionth of that. And even the realm of heat dissipation, because your brain does still have more synapses than your computer has transistors, and yet your brain does not bake itself when it runs. Even there, you can calculate the sort of minimum theoretical energy that it ought to take to do computations like that at room temperature. And once again, you should be able to get a factor of a million speed up. So knowing the laws of physics, knowing what neurons do and how they work, we can say that ought to be physically possible to have an artifact that thinks a million times as fast as a human brain without shrinking it, cooling it, using reversible computing or quantum computing, or any number of other tricks. It looks like it should be very physically straightforward to say that it is possible to have an artifact that thinks like a human brain only a million times as fast. At which rate, you could do 1 year of thinking for every 31 objective seconds. A whole year would stretch into, would go by like, not quite, that would require, you know, 10 million times as fast, but we can be fairly confident that human brains are not the fastest possible thinkers. What about the software? We're accustomed to measuring intelligence on the scale that goes from village idiot at the bottom to Einstein at the top. This is because if someone isn't at least as intelligent as a human, we don't bother dealing with them at all. And right now, well, you know, there's nothing around smarter than human, we would be having this conversation at that level of intelligence instead. I like to say that you ought to visualize the sort of absolute scale where the zero at the bottom left is a rock, then there's lizards, then there's mice, and then village idiots and Einstein, this little tiny point, practically the same point. It's almost unrealistic that I'm letting you see the difference between them on this graph over here. Software is a bit more difficult to analyze than hardware. But at the very least, we can talk about all sorts of wonderful features that a mind could in principle have, but which humans' minds don't have. For example, we cannot read or write our own source code, partially because we just don't have the access to rewire our own neurons, and partially because the human brain is a gigantic undocumented mess of spaghetti code that is not end user modifiable. You know, when we sequenced the genome, we were really hoping to find comments saying what everything did. And this wasn't there. Humans have about 4 times the relative brain size for primate our size. We've got about 4 times the brain volume of a chimpanzee. You know, 4 times as much hardware is not a significant difference these days on the scale of computer programming. You know, the significant difference is, I think I need to buy 100 times as many computers to run this code. And if you're at Google, they promote you because they're always looking for new ways to use all the computers that they have.
Yes.
You can't, you know, if you're there's something wrong with your hearing, you can't just sort of like slide out your hearing chip and slide in a new hearing chip instead. And the human brain is just sort of tremendously noisy because, well, that's the way natural selection designs things. If there's anyone here who does not believe in natural selection, I think I had better mention, tough luck, you're wrong. So what do we, I think we can guess that it is possible, it is physically permissible to have thinking artifacts which are far more powerful than human, but we can see very easily that human hardware is far short of the theoretical physical limits. There, and given that the hardware is like that, there's no reason to expect that the software is optimal, especially when you consider the biases I showed you a bit earlier. I mean, if you were designing something with this much computing power, would you really have it, you know, being able to realize that a Soviet invasion of Poland followed by a breakdown of diplomatic relations is less probable than a breakdown of diplomatic relations for any reason? All right. What else do you think you know, and how do you think you know it? In our current world today, there's a very sort of one-directional idiom. Intelligence makes technology. Now, yes, we can use technology to make things like paper, reading and writing, and in a somewhat less significant change, telephones, iPhones, and printed books and computers. But nonetheless, that does not change the fact that you have a frontal cortex over here, you have a visual cortex over here, you got temporal cortex over here, you got your thalamus in the middle. It's the same basic brain design that we were using 50,000 years ago. Sometime in the next few decades, we're going to not only be using intelligence to make technology, we are going to be using technology to improve our intelligence, whether that's by genetic engineering or neuropharmaceuticals or brain-computer interfaces or computer-assisted telepathy so we can have 64-node clustered humans, or, of course, artificial intelligence. It is nonetheless a very deep sort of sea change, that instead of just having these little constant brains off building and improving technology, we're going to have the technology loop back around and change the nature of the intelligence doing the work. Of which the most extreme form of this idiom, it would be an AI directly rewriting its own source code. The reason why people like me tend to focus on AI, you know, those who meddle in the destiny of worlds, tend to focus on AI is because if you are trying to do this via genetic engineering, it takes at least 18 years for the kids to grow up and become genetic engineers in their own right. And if you have an AI modifying its own source code, you might be able to get interesting things over the course of 18 seconds instead. In 1965, a fellow named I.J. Good, who was actually anticipated by a science fiction editor, pardon me, named John Campbell, but John Campbell didn't publish in a peer-reviewed journal, so no one remembers him. So he invented a notion that he called the intelligence explosion. The idea of which is that if you can have an artificial intelligence that it can improve its own algorithms in a way that makes itself even smarter, then it will also be smarter at the job of rewriting its own algorithms, and you get a positive feedback cycle. Now, that may eventually top out somewhere, but if the upper bounds are very far above where we are, the difference between this being, say, infinitely more intelligence than us, or merely a billion times more intelligence than us, may not make much of a difference from our perspective. And this is what's known as an intelligence explosion. And how do we know that the problems don't get more difficult? The problem of making yourself smarter does not get difficult faster than you can make yourself smarter? And the answer is we don't, but we have the following suggestive evidence. First is that going from the last common ancestor of chimps and humans to humans,
involves 4 times the brain volume or 6 times the frontal cortical area. So, and this was done by the sort of same idiom of natural selection: make a mistake, mistakes lead to differential rates of reproduction, keep the really good mistakes, lather, rinse, repeat for millions and millions of years until you get something interesting. The character of this process did not change over the last 5 million years, but it didn't seem to encounter any sort of visible major obstacles in going from the last common ancestor of chimps and humans to humans. Similarly, we've had human brains exerting a sort of roughly constant optimization pressure, or being, you know, roughly the same characteristic kind of thinkers over the last 50,000 years. And we went from flint hand axes to moon rockets, and it was not the case that as our technology improved, the problem of improving that technology got harder and harder and harder, so that we had this like logarithmic slowdown where, you know, going from rocket version 1 to rocket version 2 took 100 times as long as going from flint hand axes to rockets. We did not see anything like that. There was no slowdown. There was no logarithmic curve. We just kept on ticking. So given that that's what we see for sort of the difficulty of improving intelligence and the difficulty of creating technology, if you have an AI that is smart enough to improve itself in a way that improves its ability to improve itself, and you would expect this at some point to go a whole lot faster than the process that we've seen over the course of evolution or over the course of human history producing technology. Because in human history, every time we invented a new technology, it did not double our brain size. With an AI, every time it manages to improve its own software, it is improving that which does the improvement. Now, because of some, shall we say, unfortunate media coverage that this kind of thinking has gotten lately, I should mention that this business of an intelligence explosion does not imply nor require that more change occurred from 1970 to 2000 than from 1940 to 1970. I'm agnostic on that issue. The president of the Singularity Institute and its largest funder, Michael Vosser and Peter Thiel, both think that this is actually wrong. We had more change from 1940 to 1970 to 1970 to 2000. It does not imply, does not require, that technological progress follows a predictable curve, and you can say that the intelligence explosion will occur on April 27th, 2031, between 4 and 4:30 in the morning. And the singularity in the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, you know, back when we named ourselves, it meant the intelligence explosion. Nowadays, singularity is this sort of really loose term that means any sort of amazing, cool technology you like, being produced at around the same rate it is right now, so that you can have a cool little graph that predicts exactly when you get anything. This is not what we advocate. And if we were going to name our institute today, we'd probably pick a different name. So, what do we think we can guess? We can guess that over some threshold level of required intelligence, an AI can recursively self-improve and undergo a very rapid ascent leading to superintelligence before it tops out. Now, this is not true with every possible self-improving AI you could try to build. It has to be good enough to make deep changes to itself. It probably has to understand the concepts that went into its own creation as well as you understand them, at least if you're going to do this right. It's not necessarily easy. I don't claim to have the slightest idea of when this is going to happen, except to say that it will probably be between, say, 5 minutes and 500 years from now. And if you actually said, what does your behavior show? You think that you're what sort of predicted median arrival time are you acting as if? It would probably come out to acting as if like 2035 or something like that. But you want to put very wide bounds on your confidence interval around a guess like that. What else do I think I know, and how do I think I know it? This goes back to the idea that the space of possible mind designs is much larger than the human space of mind designs. Human beings are really remarkably similar to each other. there's a list of human universals, which is actually much longer than this. It's an entire book on all the things that anthropologists have found in every single human culture that has ever been studied. They all make tools. They all have weapons. They all speak languages within a certain class of grammars. They all have tickling. They all have known times for meals. They all have conflicts and mediation of those conflicts. They dance, they sing, they have personal names, they make promises and are offended if you break them. They mourn their dead, and the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Now, why should that be? Why are human beings so similar? A complex adaptation must be universal within a sexually reproducing species. Suppose you have a complex adaptation. It's one of those big, powerful adaptations that has lots of moving parts, some piece of complicated machinery in biology. We'll say that there are 6 genes necessary to make this, which is actually a pretty simple piece of machinery, as such things go. And if each of those 6 necessary genes are 10% frequency within the gene pool, then even if you have one person who has a complete version of this adaptation, the next time they reproduce, their offspring will get 3 in 6 of the genes on average, and in general, the machinery will just get hopelessly scrambled unless it's universal. At any given time, you can have sort of selection on individual tweaks to the machinery, but not lots of independent, you can be selecting on the tweaks, but you can't be selecting on lots of independent genes that come together to form a useful, complicated machine. Evolution has to evolve incrementally. You start with the gene that's advantageous by itself. You get, then once A has evolved to universality, you can get another gene B that depends on A. If A has not evolved to universality at the time the gene B comes along, if A is only 1% prevalent in the population when B comes along, then that means that the fitness advantage represented by B decreases by a factor of 100, and that means that B will probably never rise to universality. But once you do have A, you can get B that depends on A, and then you can have an alternative version of A that depends on the presence of B. And once you've got A prime and B, you can have C that depends on A prime and B, and so on and so forth until you have these complex machines with hundreds of parts which will fall apart if you remove any one of them. Which, of course, some people quite incorrectly take as evidence of intelligent design, and the main sort of differential prediction is that whenever you find a piece of complex machinery like that, you should be able to look around and find predecessors that are simpler, have fewer of the same parts. If you're designing something intelligently, there's no reason to have simpler predecessors around. If you're evolving something, there were simpler predecessors at some point in history, and you can probably find some traces of. I'd like to note at this point that there was a famous biologist named J.B.S. Haldane who was once asked, what would falsify evolution, the theory of evolution? To which J.B.S. Haldane immediately snapped back, rabbit fossils in the Precambrian. Something else that would falsify the theory of evolution is the X-Men. Over here we have Storm, who, unlike either of her parents, can throw lightning bolts. Her body can generate the electricity, control the electricity, and not be hurt by the electricity. If anything like that happens in one mutation, the theory of natural selection has been falsified. And when you apply this logic to the brain, then of course you have any bit of complex machinery in the brain. We can have slightly different versions of it, maybe, but we all need to have the same basic complex machine. We all have frontal cortex, we all have visual cortex. Sometimes you can knock out a single gene and someone is born without an auditory cortex, they're missing the piece of functional machinery. But by and large, the fact that brain machinery is complicated means that everyone has the same engine running under the hood, we are just painted slightly different colors. This sometimes leads to another class of rather entertaining mistakes in movies. Consider The Matrix. At first we have Agent Smith, who at first appears sort of cold and emotionless. But the people who write the script for these movies are incapable of conceiving of a mind truly different from their own. They do not understand their own design, and so they do not understand how to conceive of a mind with a different design. And in particular, the only way they know how to model something that is emotionless is to imagine an emotionally repressed human. They sort of imagine themselves being very emotionally repressed, and they put themselves into the artificial intelligence's shoes, which of course yields the prediction that as soon as you are under enough stress, your repression will fail and the artificial intelligence will start showing emotions. And in particular, Agent Smith will be disgusted with his enemy Morpheus over here, and he will look disgusted. He will have the human universal expression for disgust. Because one of the things that is the same among all studied cultures is there are the same facial expressions wired up to the same emotions. We all smile when we're happy, we all frown when we're sad. It is not culturally specific, it's in the wiring. And what do you know, the artificial intelligences in the movies have the same facial expressions as humans, to say nothing of the same emotions. There's this class of science, not so much science fiction as bad illustrations, where you've got the monster carrying off the girl in a torn dress. For some reason, it's never the monster, a female monster carrying off a man in a torn shirt. Now, what could the person who drew this picture possibly have been thinking? Are they thinking about the logic of natural selection and saying, I bet a swamp monster would evolve to find human females reproductively attractive? No. What they're thinking is, this woman seems attractive, therefore the monster will be attracted to her. Like, the property of being attractive is a property of the woman herself and not the mind looking at the woman. It's another case of the mind projection fallacy, which is sort of, I suspect, one of the really basic errors in philosophy is to take something that is a property of your mind and project it onto the external world. We think that certain things are desirable, but actually it is a property of a mind that it desires them. And there is a common fallacy in incautious futurism, which runs like this. The first premise is that the smarter you are, the larger a cheesecake you can bake. And the second premise is that Moore's Law continues to give us more and more computing power. And from this, we can deduce that the future will be full of giant cheesecakes. Power does not imply motive. I think I can guess that features of human nature that we take for granted because they are so universal in our everyday practice are not necessary features of all possible minds. The human subspace of possibilities is this tiny little dot we're all packed into within this much larger space of minds in general. And not all possible agents in that space have the same motives. In particular, not all of them find niceness to be, to them, desirable. Now, if we can have possible artificial intelligences that are very smart and not nice, am I going to tell you, don't panic? No, I think panic is actually a smart move at this point. I'm not going to tell you not to panic prematurely because I actually suspect that we are panicking post-maturely. If we panic any later, we will be panicking posthumously. Nonetheless, the problem of the possibility of constructing very smart minds that are not necessarily your friends is one that I do not think can be solved by, say, banning the study of artificial intelligence. Though I would fully encourage you personally not to build artificial intelligences that will destroy the world. I know that not all of you in this audience are going to take that injunction to heart. And so what one would like to do would be to construct something that is smarter than us and nice. There is a suggestion that among the things we can know is that this is impossible. And the argument is you can't predict what a mind smarter than you will do, because in order to predict what a smarter mind than you would do, you would have to be that smarter self. For example, if you have a chess playing machine and you can predict exactly what move it will make at every turn, or actually let's just take Garry Kasparov, who used to be the human world champion of chess before machines beat him out there. If you can predict exactly where Kasparov will move on the chessboard, you must be at least as good a chess player as Kasparov, because you can always just move wherever you predict Kasparov will move. For those of you who are here because you read Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, one of the sort of secret agendas of Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality is that geniuses in all the other science fiction or fantasy that you try to read are really no smarter than the author. They may be able to make amazing, cool devices. They may be able to solve problems that a real person could not solve in their shoes because the author is just letting them solve it. But their choices within the framework of the story are not actually going to be any smarter than the smartest choice the author could possibly make. This makes all fiction about geniuses have this sort of horrible fakeness about them. And one of the reasons why people like Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, and some of them have even worked out that this is why they like Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, is that the characters in it are not merely geniuses in theory who can make amazing devices, they are people who actually do smart things within the context of the story. So I, of course, do that by cheating and being smart enough to simulate all the characters in Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. But if it comes to an actual artificial intelligence, you can't cheat. It actually is smarter than you. So the argument is you can't know anything about it, and in particular, you can't know if it's going to be nice or not nice. But consider, you can't actually program a chess-playing AI by programming every position into it, by taking every possible chess position, looking at the chess position, saying what seems to you like the best move in that chess position, and pre-programming that move into the AI. That's the equivalent of the artificial arithmetician that I was talking about earlier, just sort of programming in every fact independently. You can't do that because there are too many possible chess positions. And the insight that you need to solve this apparently impossible problem, to perform this paradoxical feat of creating a machine that plays better chess than you do, is to realize that the code you write does not specify a move in each position. The code you write specifies a search. In particular, it tries to figure out the consequences of a move. It looks into the possible moves that could be made after its own move. Where could Kasparov go? Then where could I go? Then where could Kasparov go? And tries to predict which moves lead to the space of final chess boards, final game outcomes, where its own side has won the game, because that is what we defined Deep Blue, the chess playing AI, to want. Deep Blue's programmers could not predict its exact moves. Okay, well, if you can't predict the moves, why not use a random move generator? Isn't that just as good? No, because the unpredictability of a superior intelligence is not like the unpredictability of random noise or flipping a fair coin. And in particular, the unpredictable moves that Deep Blue was making had the consequence of winning the game. Or to state that a bit more precisely, it was a predictable fact about Deep Blue that it would try to find winning moves and try to find moves that led to the consequence of winning states of the board. You cannot ever prove by looking at your own code that a given move is going to have a given consequence in the real world. The real world is uncertain. It is incompletely known, and sometimes you don't have enough computing power to use even now the knowledge that you have. But what you can determine by looking at the code of an AI is that the search it is performing to find its action is by extrapolating the consequences of that action and looking for consequences that fall into the space that we would regard as good. Of course, in order to do that, you have to define what means good within the AI, which is a more complex topic that I do not think I actually, let me check and see if I've got this in here. No, I don't actually have it in there, and probably shouldn't because it's a rather complicated topic. But if it has free access to its own source code, can't it just overwrite whatever utility function you try to program into it? Well, Gandhi doesn't want to kill people. Let's say you offer Gandhi a pill that makes him want to kill people. Will Gandhi take this pill? I predict not. Or at least if Gandhi correctly realizes that this is what the pill does, Gandhi will refuse the pill because the current Gandhi doesn't want people to die. And this is a sort of rough outline of that there ought to exist some sort of theorem that we presently can't prove because we, you know, don't quite understand the decision theory of self-modifying AIs, which is what I actually work on when I'm not writing the nonfiction book on rationality I'm currently working on, or Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality. But there ought to exist a theorem, even though we don't currently know what theorem to prove, let alone how to prove it, which says that if you are a rational agent and you are able to understand the effect of changes to your source code upon yourself, you should, will in general, try to preserve your utility function as you try to self-modify, self-improve, write your code to be better at searching for actions that lead to the consequences you want. You will not modify your utility function doing that. If you start out nice, you'll stay nice. If you start out non-nice, you'll stay non-nice. If you start out trying to maximize the number of paper clips in the universe, then as you improve your own intelligence, you will want to go on wanting to maximize the number of paper clips in the universe. Until, and if you are successful in becoming super intelligent, the universe will end up full of paper clips. To avoid the dreaded paperclip maximizer, we would like the first AI that gets smart enough to repeatedly improve itself and become super intelligent to be friendly, nice, benevolent. There's probably a certain amount of demand, I would guess, for you to know what the heck I mean by that. Correct me if I'm mistaken here. It looks like I actually do have enough time to describe that very briefly. So our current proposal is to have an AI that looks at people, learns models of how they make decisions, extrapolates those models toward what is called a reflective equilibrium by asking not what would you want me to do, but what would you want me to do if you knew everything I knew, thought as fast as I did, and can consider as many options as I can consider, and had my ability as an AI to completely know my own mental state and modify myself so as not to have any unwanted weakness of will. This is the notion in moral philosophy of a reflective equilibrium, the limit of what you would want as you approach perfect knowledge, the ability to consider all the options, and no unwanted weakness of self-control. And it is the closest that moral philosophy has ever come to defining in a sort of computationally describable way what it means to do what you should. And the current proposal at the Singularity Institute is, if you can build a recursively self-improving artificial intelligence, you ought to extrapolate the reflective equilibria of everyone on the planet and have the AI do whatever those reflective equilibria tend to agree the AI should do. That was our attempt to define good in a way that you can actually compute on a sufficiently smart, within a sufficiently smart AI. Whereupon the super intelligence goes on to do all sorts of wonderfully nice things, and we all live happily ever after. So if you have ever wondered what people do nowadays that we don't believe in magic anymore, when they try to meddle in the destiny of the world, and preferably in a nice fashion, this is it. For more information, visit lesswrong.com, yudkowsky.net, or singins.org. Thank you, and I'll assume that there are no questions.
'Consider
the simple case of an expected paperclip maximizer. Now, it's an expected utility maximizer whose utility function is count the paperclips, that is my utility. Then an expected paperclip maximizer does want to improve itself. It wants to make itself smarter. It wants to acquire more resources so it can get things done in the real world. It wants to improve the technologies it has available. It wants to develop nanotechnology. And wipe out all the humans and turn the galaxies into paperclips. So it does want to make itself smarter, but at some point it also wants to make paperclips. The only reason it wants to make itself smarter is because it anticipates that by carrying out the action of rewriting its own code to more efficiently search for ways to make paperclips, it will in fact end up with more paperclips.
But will it ever actually end up with any paperclips, right?
You're proposing that the superintelligence does something that is, under its own criterion of preference, extremely stupid. You're proposing that it just goes into this really stupid failure mode. If I'm going to improve myself, and never make any paperclips, which from its perspective is just about the worst thing it can possibly do, sort of actually destroying paperclips. And this is what I expect to be the sort of general rule for any intelligence that has a coherent utility function. It wants to improve itself, it wants to be smarter, it wants to have more resources, all the ones that don't explicitly want to be nice to humans, think that you are made of atoms that it can use for something else. It's not that it hates you, it's just that you are taking up valuable space. The ones that are nice to humans want to be nice to you, and you better have very carefully defined what nice means in that case. But in general, like, you would not expect superintelligences to fall into the really obvious trap, so obvious that even you and I can see it's a trap, of making a change to their code which locks them into a never-ending cycle of self-improvement and never allows them to take any external actions leading to the fulfillment of their goals. Most numbers are very much larger than a billion.
I would say there's something that tells two sources for
them. Sorry?
I would say that it could live, a computer could like run by itself until, like, should there be AI and everything, it will run until the resources to keep it running run out.
Until the protons decay, our current model of physics. And perhaps there is some clever way, which we have not currently figured out, to actually run forever. But so what?
No, I'm
asking him, like, so what? Okay, so perhaps these computers are eternal. If they are nice computers, they will presumably make us immortal as well, because that thing, not very nice. Expecto Patronum. Sorry, only somebody got that. But suppose that it is physically possible to do an infinite amount of computing. What follows from this? Okay. Next question.
You're talking about the mistake that people often make attributing human characteristics to aliens or
swamp monsters or artificial intelligences.
Is it possible that this whole approach is doing that? Like, people want to do things. Animals also want to do things. What makes you think that a machine is ever going to want to do something?
Well, a lot of machines, such as a can opener, do not want to do anything. However, the class of AIs that we're interested in order to have large effects upon the world, you know, the class of AIs that we're interested in are optimizers. They try to steer the future to a particular place. Now, internally, that may not look like the same sort of experience that you and I have when we want something, but if you can't look at the AI and say, this is where it's trying to steer the future, this is how it's choosing actions in order to send the future to a particular place, that's probably not the sort of AI that can save or destroy the world, and hence, by the standards of the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, boring.
Yeah.
Trying to remember who had their hand up first. I'll just pick you, even though it's probably the wrong decision.
Thank you. Your question that you asked through Sakadish, in response to that, so what if it's internal? Well, doesn't that mean a computer can continually optimize itself because it doesn't see a deadline for creating, for filling the universe with paperclips? And it will never start filling the universe with paperclips because I still have more time for that.
Okay, so the first point is, as long as it has not yet taken over the world, if it doesn't do then over time there is an increasing risk, because you're integrating the risk over time, there's increasing risk of it, of some other AI that is a little less patient coming along and squishing it, or even the humans coming along and squishing it, or the humans building another AI that's squishing it, or the aliens squish it. Or for that matter, if you look at the stars are wastefully shining all over the galaxy. They're wasting large amounts of irreplaceable energy, at least on the current theory of physics. The stars are wasting electricity that we can never replace. We're using up negentropy, to be precise. So, and if we're talking about the kind of artificial intelligence that the Singularity Institute would like to build, then you are supposed to be nice to people. There are all these people around the world who are currently in non-nice situations. So it is preferable to do something now than to simply wait forever, because right now there is disutility going on.
What do you do all day?
What makes you think that I do anything? Okay. So right now I'm writing a book on human rationality. Tentative title for volume one is How to Actually Change Your Mind. What I do for fun at present is write a little story called Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, which as soon as it gets another 200 reviews, will be the third most reviewed Harry Potter fan fiction online out of around 500,000 contenders. Because it turns out that people are, it's surprising, but it turns out people are actually starving for rationality. You know, they are experiencing clarity starvation because they cannot actually find rationality anywhere in their daily lives or the world, because the world is crazy. And so they rather like it in the fiction. You know, even though in the real world everything's still crazy. And when I'm done writing my book on rationality, I'm supposed to go and do the decision theory of self-modifying AIs, because right now we do not know how to describe an AI that modifies itself while preserving the same utility function, even given infinite computing power. There are problems we understand exactly how to solve given infinite computing power, like playing chess. The problem of how to build a self-improving AI that preserves its original utility function is one we do not know how to solve even given infinite computing power. So when I'm done writing my book on rationality, I'm going to go back to working on the reflective decision theory of self-modifying AIs. In short, this is my day job.
Yes, it is.
Well, actually, the person behind you.
Sorry. You mentioned that you don't yet have all the insights necessary to understand intelligence. Do you know what we might be looking for?
Yes. The exact insights we're currently missing are...
Do you have any idea what they might look like when we stumble upon?
Well, for example, we are clearly missing some sort of deep insight involving reflectivity, which is why we don't have any AIs that self-improve in an interesting way. We cannot describe the problem of self-improvement even given infinite computing power. And you know, the aspect where we think about ourselves is one of the least understood aspects of human thought. So if you want an example of a pretty clear outline of a missing puzzle piece. I would point to that as an example. Now you
is good and evil the only thing you'll like keep? I mean, say you basically have some sort of artificial intelligence and wanted to do good and not evil. So is good and evil gonna keep it? The concept of good and evil, is that alone gonna keep it? Going to keep it good? Because I learned in Jewish philosophy that good and evil, it's in the Torah, you're not allowed to kill, and you have people that can like argue on it.
No, they never argue. Sorry.
Okay. What I'm saying is, people can rationalize, people could do evil and they can rationalize and make it seem good. So how
right.
do
you
know the so, robots? Well, if you teach them good and evil,
so you should have learned in your evolutionary psychology courses at Yeshiva that. The reason why human beings rationalize is because we are, our ancestors were faced with political problems inside their little 50-person tribes. If you manage to persuade the tribe that, you know, giving you that nice new spear was the way to, was really the best thing to do for the good of the tribe, you tended to out-reproduce people who failed to come up with convincing arguments for why whatever it was they wanted was the best thing for the tribe. So we've presumably got actual little modules inside our head somewhere, complex adaptations, chunks of brainware, explicitly devoted to taking things we sort of secretly want for selfish reasons and coming up with reasons why this is really the best possible thing you could do according to whatever morals are represented inside our brain. You know, the example I use for illustration is someone who says, you know, I think I'm going to eat that entire chocolate cake over there. Why are you going to do that? Well, you know, I hear the sugar industry is in trouble, so I'm going to eat that chocolate cake to help the sugar industry. Well, you know, if you really want to help the sugar industry and keep to your diet, why not buy the chocolate cake and then throw it out? Or better yet, just mail the sugar in some sugar farmer a check. Oh, well, it would be wasteful to throw out the chocolate cake, and I don't have any stamps on me right now. The post office is so far out of my, it's too far out of my way, so really the only way I can help the sugar industry is to eat this entire chocolate cake. This is not a natural thing that all Bayesian optimal rational agents automatically do. This is a thing that humans do in the little tiny dot that is, are all human mind designs, because this is what we evolved to do, and it's how we evolved to play politics. Now, why a benevolent God would just design you that way is not a question I care to entertain, but it is clear why natural selection would design you that way. And we're just not going to design our AIs that way, so they're not going to do that.
How so?
That take the optimal action given their state of uncertainty. So what you're guaranteeing by looking at the code is not what this AI does always works, it's that the AI is processing its uncertainty about the world in a lawful way, as opposed to the way humans do it, and that it is actually doing the thing which is expected to lead to the best consequences, unlike humans who rationalize their like little selfish urges according to their morals. So you can't build it perfect, but you can build it a lot better than you.
I have a question about reflecting equilibrium, and this might be pedantry, but I'm asking because I'm not sure. The question is why you would have the AI consider what all the people in the world would have wanted it to do versus versus the people that you agree with?
Because in the latter case, I would be taking over the world, which would cause my TV Tropes page to list me as a villain.
Well, so more specifically, I can think of, for example, 1.5 billion people who would probably want the AI to kill everyone who goes to the university called Yeshiva.
But would they still want that even if they knew everything the AI knew, thought as fast as the AI did, and knew about as much about themselves as the AI knows about them?
What would that change their utility functions?
They don't have utility functions. They're humans. Humans don't have utility functions. We've got this giant mess of conflicting emotions. That's why it's going to be one of the more interesting parts of this whole project is going to be saying, okay, you have now learned a model of human decision making. How do you actually get a utility function, a consistent utility function, back out of that, as opposed to the giant mess you started with? But in terms of the sort of possibility that, well, you know, everyone else in the world just was evil, and it wasn't a mistake, they want to be evil. Some of the things you can do to try and stop that are have one or more humans on a jury sort of peek at what the AI is going to do and say yes or no once, not control it, not shape it, not exert detailed steering on it, just say yes or no once before running the AI. The other thing you could do would be to say, extrapolate the reflective equilibria of all current donors to this, of all previous donors to the Singularity Institute, weighted by the percentage of income donated since they learned about the Singularity Institute, and give that a single binary yes or no veto on whether to run the main AI. Not shape it in detail, you know, not control it, not tweak it, just say, is this what I wanted my donations to be used for or not? Boy, that got a lot of questions.
So, is that your attempt to persuade us to donate to the Singularity Institute?
What he means to say is, are you holding the world hostage now?
No, because that would cause my TV Tropes. But if you want your reflective equilibrium to have a more than usual weighted, you know, not effect on the world, but just an ability to veto the rest of the world in case it does something you don't like, then yes, clearly you should donate to the Singularity Institute. You should also donate to the Singularity Institute if you have a preference between the world being destroyed by a hostile superintelligence that goes on to turn the galaxies into paperclips and nothing else much interesting, versus all of us living happily ever after and going on to create a wonderful, nice intergalactic civilization full of sentient beings having fun, full of diverse and novel experiences, et cetera, et cetera. So if you actually have a preference between those two outcomes, I would make the case that your next marginal dollar of donation has a higher expected utility at the Singularity Institute than anywhere else on the planet. But this will only be of interest to those of you who are interested in doing the right thing, which I expect from experience to be very few of you. Harder to define. Is if it were literally indefinable, then the problem would not be that it was hard to make the AI calculate the answer to your question, but that it simply did not have any sort of answer you could reasonably get. And I think that, for example, that most people in the world would rather not be turned into paperclips. And I would, you know, that's, I think, actually an important preference. Well, I think that in the limit of the AI's knowledge, the AI's thought speed, and knowing as much about yourself as the AI knows about you, that there actually would be a sort of space of things that people could agree upon as it's okay for the AI to help us this way. There's clearly a lot of ways we would prefer not to be helped, but you know, say, if you actually understood the consequences, instead of this whole aging business where you slowly get stupider until you finally die, you know, maybe everyone should go up and have like one increased IQ point per year or something like that.
Well, when you're playing the chess game, you don't really care about the middle ground. You only care about the end game. In this case, we care about what happens along the way.
Right, so you have utility function over four-dimensional world.
Because that requires people to predict what it's going to do, which we said we can't predict the middle part of the chess game.
Well,
right?
Well, no, the idea is that the utility function is over histories of the world. It's not trying to steer the whole world towards some nice final outcome and heck with what happens along the way. It's trying to steer reality into the space of nice histories. So you are allowed to care about what happens along the way. You are allowed to care about the intervening states.
But we don't, isn't the whole point that we don't know necessarily what's going to happen in the middle?
Well, we wouldn't know how exactly the AI would help us, just that whatever happens, it will be very nice.
Right, the end might be nice, but the process might not be.
Well, no, you could know that the process was also going to be nice. In other words, we wouldn't know how the AI, which actions the AI would take, but we could say these actions are being chosen according to the criterion, not just of ending up with some sort of nice state a billion years later, but according to the criterion of also caring about what happens to human beings on a moment-by-moment basis. So you still wouldn't know how exactly it's going to help you, but you would know what it cares about. And what it cares about is not just the state of the universe in 10 billion years. What it cares about is what happens to you 1 minute from now. It's
so
allowed to care about.
Wouldn't that require it to kind of, I mean, often things that are like bad in the moment are then like good for you later on, so to speak, right? Like your parents always tell you that. So like how big picture is the AI going to think, right? Like this will be bad for this generation of people, but later on it'll be better ultimately.
Well, I'd expect that you wouldn't actually have to make many trade-offs like that. I mean, trade-offs like that are things that we have to do because we are stupid and don't have molecular nanotechnology. I mean, there's no reason to, you know, say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to live in poverty for this generation so that the next generation can have chocolate.
Right, but this generation is going to have all the food they want, but they're not going to have to work for any of it. And they're not going to have a system in place where they have to work for anything, so they're not really going to feel fulfilled.
Right, so you wouldn't do that. You would do something else instead.
Telling it do what a bunch of people want.
You're saying, look at the existing humans, understand their goal systems, extrapolate them toward reflective equilibrium, and then do what those goal systems want. So that is a particular design which indeed will not work, and which you do tend to hear a lot of other people proposing horrible designs like that. But that is not the particular design that we plan to use, and we do have some hopes that ours is not horrible. Two parents have two children is linear growth, and we can expand it most cubically, assuming the laws of physics work basically the way we think they do. The problem is not population growth, the problem is exponential population growth. The only way you can get away with exponential population growth is if you can manage to manufacture new universes at an exponential rate, which there are some versions of the laws of physics that would theoretically let us do, but it is not mainstream physics. But, so, you know, if you've got like two parents have two children, and that's it, and then those two children have two children, and that's it, then you have linear population growth, which gives you another linear factor for everyone's brains getting larger at a linear rate, and then another linear resource factor for good luck, just in case we need it, because you can expand cubically in all directions until you run out of matter. And that's
you're like, you want to get, you're hoping that's top of mind.
How do I put it, but I mean, like, if that's actually an irreducible dilemma, if there's literally no way, even with molecular nanotechnology, to have a pleasant galaxy on the other end without punching someone in the nose, then a nice AI actually should punch that person in the nose, as you have defined the dilemma.
Right, so how do you, where are your boundaries for that?
Well, my boundaries are, there's literally no way to save the galaxy but to punch someone in the nose, and I'm an AI, and I have incredibly good information, and I can actually trust myself not to be rationalizing, you know, secretly selfish or evil desires, because I actually know what my source code is computing, and I know and can trust my own source code's evaluation of the fact that the only way to save the galaxy is to punch someone in the nose, then the correct thing for the AI to do is to punch that person in the nose. I'm biting that bullet.
But that's like the most black and white situation ever. I mean.
Well, yeah.
then
there's the obvious generalization to probabilities. Right? That's not obvious. Well, you know, if there's 90% probability that the only way to save the galaxy is by punching someone in the nose, you still punch someone in the nose. And you know, eventually it gets less black and white. And then, you know, the decisions that are almost exactly evenly balanced, well, it doesn't really matter that much which one you do, which is what makes them balanced. But, you know, the AI will just, you know, like, choose the better option. Professor Kelly.
Sorry?
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. About embodiment. That the human brain has come to have its rational capability because it's embodied in a rich sensory motor environment. In fact, there's evidence that if a human brain develops deprived of that, it will not form the rich synaptic connections that make rational thought possible. What kinds of embodiment do you think are going to be needed in order to reach that next level of superintelligence that differ qualitatively from what we see in biological environments today?
So I suspect that when you are starting out with a young and stupid AI, you will want to construct artificial virtual environments that are much more manageable for a young and stupid AI than the over-complexity of the real world. I do not actually think that to get a super intelligence you would need super bandwidth, but I expect that as a super intelligence it would nonetheless want super bandwidth and build sensory devices to get it anyway. The thing to remember about the human brain is that given that it has evolved in a rich sensory environment, there is no reason for its wiring algorithms not to depend on the environment. If it is a reliable invariant of the ancestral environment that when you grow up, your eyes are already exposed to a complex visual world, there is no reason for the wiring algorithms not to depend upon this reliable feature of the environment that it will present you with all this visual information. It doesn't mean that you could not, in principle, have a brain that would wire up correctly, even in the absence of all that visual information during its formative period. There's merely no reason for natural selection to design a brain that way. It's also certain that we humans are making far less efficient use of our sensory information than the theoretical optimum. And if you look at the sort of things that cryptographers do to extract information from a message where one bit, yes or no, can be the make or break bit that puts you onto the right track to crack the whole message. If you look at our physicists who have to reconstruct particles from a state of relative information poverty, you know, they can only get all these little bubble chamber graphs and so on. Or if you look at cosmologists who have to constrain their theories using not nearly as much information about distant galaxies as they like. These people are inspecting every bit of their data far more intensely than we inspect our own visual fields. If we got a message from an alien civilization that was just 4 frames of video, if we got a message from aliens in another dimension, in another universe, different laws of physics, that was just 4 frames of video, we would be there trying to deduce their equivalents of gravity and Newtonian laws just by looking at those four frames of video and doing the equivalent of cryptography and physicists trying to constrain their theories and cosmologists trying to constrain their theories off of four picture frames of video. So there, the amount of information that you can extract in principle out of the human sensory stream is tremendously greater than what humans actually extract. Nonetheless, I would expect a superintelligence to have, you know, high bandwidth sensors because it can use it and it can build it, and why not?
It seems that in the flexible equilibrium, when you want the AI to take everyone's preferences into account, weighted equally, without this donor-decided complication, it would be really nice if people had all the knowledge that these superintelligence would have, that they would all become basically secular humanists, or basically have goals which are not incompatible with secular humanism, so that...
Well, it goes without saying that in the ideal of perfect knowledge, everyone agrees with me. But go on.
So is there, and then if in fact you do really have a sharp fact-value distinction, and no matter how much information you give someone, because he's decided to believe in a god once and to kill someone of a different skin color, he will continue to believe that. And this AI, the AI knows this. Is that eventually, under the assumption that there are sufficient numbers of people like that to screw up this whole reflective equilibrium, doesn't that present at least a minor snag in plans?
So this is a question about the details of how you extrapolate someone's reflective equilibrium, which in turn is a special case of the deep question. When people believe things that are not true and inform their opinions in the presence of beliefs that are not true and have many conflicting and incoherent desires, how do you say what it is that they want? And how is it that if you are genuinely trying to help them, you give them what they would want if they weren't so confused? And if I were going to extrapolate someone who firmly, someone in India, we'll say, who believes that everyone in Pakistan is evil and ought to die. If you actually went up to them and asked them, well, you know, suppose you're actually wrong about everyone in Pakistan being inherently evil, what should you do then? And they say, it's impossible that I'm wrong. So the answer is still die. Then I don't think that you would want to build a super intelligent AI that would construe their reflective equilibrium in such fashion as to actually go with that. I think you'd start with the person's knowledge and goal system and just force swap in the knowledge that the people in Pakistan are not inherently evil, and that the original sort of politically charged decision was taken based on false premises. You extrapolate them as if they simply knew that before you start asking the reflective equilibrium, what do you want to do about the fact that your real self is still deluded?
I think we'll take two more questions and then
edit. More questions, okay.
By swapping in these ideas, you're assuming the person designs a system is smarter than the reflective equilibrium of that particular subgroup.
Well,
or has the ability to override their decisions. You're saying that if everybody in Pakistan thought everybody in India was evil, and the person designs a system is going to design it such that it discounts that information, that's assuming that the person designs a system is smarter or has the ability to override the reflexive equilibrium of that subgroup of people.
Well, no, it's a question of how you are going to define this non-natural notion of reflective equilibrium. I mean, there is no fact of the matter as to, you know, your reflective equilibrium is not printed on the back of your neck. It's an attempt to construe from a human what that human would want. And there is no obvious initial single correct way to do that. And you're certainly not telling the AI, discount the opinions of everyone in Pakistan.
What you are doing is saying, while you define reflective equilibrium, you're not telling it who's right, you're not telling it who's wrong, but you are telling it that people make mistakes and get really caught up in those mistakes, no matter how caught up they are in those mistakes, you are nonetheless to try and extrapolate what they would want if they simply knew the truth. And you're saying that in general, without adaptation, and without trying to say who in this planet is right and who in this planet is wrong. If you want
in
to
other words, the machine is smart enough to figure out that people don't mean what they say.
It had, if it's a super intelligence, it had darn well better be smart enough to figure out that people often don't mean what they say. All the way in the back.
What are the theological implications?
Sorry?
Speak up. What are the theological implications of artificial intelligence, of super artificial intelligence?
To cast this in Beis Hillel versus Beis Shammai terms. Okay. Insofar as I myself do not believe that the axioms of theology are consistent, I am unable to get deductions from the theological axioms plus the further fact of superintelligence. And I think that that's the suddenly disappear in a puff of smoke, preventing any of you with further questions from coming up to me afterward and talking to me. And, thank you very much. I have to have you.